This episode is brought to you by RPGNow.com, your leading source of PDF gaming products, and GamersAddict.com, your source for physical game products at a discount, supporting a local store. And with the coupon code RADIO, you get an additional $3 off the purchase of $30. And listeners like you, thanks for using the Tome's affiliate link and Amazon store.
VorpalNetwork.com.
Hi, this is Wolfgang Bauer, author of Forge of War, Expedition to the Demon Web Pits, and a whole lot of independent games you probably don't know. If you don't listen to the Tome, you're a sad, sorry man.
Welcome to the Tome, episode 110. The Tome is a D&D news, reviews, and interview show, and I'm your Tome host, Jeff Greiner. In this episode, we're leading a martial squad against a horde of unusual creatures with the human warlord and making unique monsters. That's right, I'm continuing my goal of making every fifth episode an advice episode, since all the feedback on previous advice episodes has been good. And today, I brought back someone from one of my first interviews on the show. He's world-renowned game designer, Al-Kadim creator, open design guru, and head kobold over at Kobold Quarterly. That's right, it's the Monkey King himself. I'd like to welcome back to the show Wolfgang Bauer.
Hey, ook ook ook, it's good to be back.
It's been a long time.
It has.
It's been almost, what, 2 years, I think, since you were first on the show?
We keep saying that I'm coming back, and I keep meaning to, and then, you know, things happen. I have projects.
Yeah. So, speaking of those projects, let's give you a chance to talk a little bit about that. What have you been up to lately?
Well, just in the last couple of weeks here, I've been pushing Kobold Quarterly 10 out to press. We've got some great 4th edition skill challenges in there. We've got a Pathfinder sneak preview. We've got stuff for warlocks. We've got monsters. It's huge. It's our biggest issue yet. So I've been excited about that one. And even huger, at 175 pages, the Halls of the Mountain King open design adventure went out to its patrons this past week. So a huge underground dungeon-delving dwarves and gold kind of story.
Sweet.
Yeah. Oh, it turned out extremely well. And
what edition is that?
It's both 3rd edition, which just shipped, and 4th edition, where we're just now burning down the whole set of and building them one by one so that the whole story arc stays the same. But all of the stats and encounters are rebuilt with different monsters for 4th edition.
Great.
Yeah. No, it's great seeing the differences.
And on the subject of designing things for 4th edition, have you started pestering Wizards of the Coast to bring back Al-Kadim?
No, I haven't. I know that there's an audience for it, a surprisingly large audience for Al-Kadim. I did Six Arabian Nights for open design. I've seen the Legacy of Fire adventure path come out from Paizo, but I don't think WotC is going to do Al-Kadim as their setting for this coming year or even next year. Yeah. It was such a critical hit, but yeah, I don't think it's coming back.
You don't think it's going to come back at all?
Well, I think it'll come back as like a single-shot source book at some point, like 3 years into the 4th edition lifespan, you know, like in 2 years from now. Maybe they'll put out something kind of like an Oriental Adventures book that will just do a few classes and maybe, I don't know, something with the elemental power source if they'd go that road. But I wish it weren't true, but I just can't see it. They've got so many other settings lined up first.
Yeah. And I have my suspicion as to which one we're going to see next. But I know they've been pretty mum about it over at Wizards.
Ravenloft? You got a favorite?
You're guessing Ravenloft?
I would like Ravenloft. Let's put it that way. But I think it's going to be Dragonlance.
Yeah, I do too. I don't know which ones I would prefer. But I think it's going to be Dragonlance because I think the timing is just too ideal.
Yeah. So. It's pretty sweet. But we'll see. We'll see soon.
Yeah. Well, everyone should be happy to have you back on the show. I know I am. You have some unique experiences bringing or brought to D&D, and hopefully that means some unique advice. Today we're going to build a human warlord, and then you had some ideas you wanted to share about building some awesome monsters for people's games. Plus, I have a secret extra topic to ask you about if there's extra time at the end.
Sure.
But first, I wanted to mention our first sponsor, RPGNow.com. My pick for this episode is Kobold Ecologies, appropriately enough. Currently under $10 at RPG Now for all 104 pages of the PDF. And rather than read to you about the product off of the webpage, I thought I'd let Wolfgang tell you a little bit about it since, you know, you published it and all.
Sure. Well, the ecologies of, you know, they go back to the days when Ed Greenwood and Jonathan Richards wrote them for Dragon magazine, and we've been doing them with Kobold Quarterly and in Open Design for a while. Everybody loves them. And so I said, why not collect all the best ones? Why not put a whole bunch of new ones together? And why not get an RPG superstar like Clinton Boomer to write a couple? And we did. We took, I think, a dozen or 14 ecologies and edited them, got some new art, and it's everything, right? It's the Retriever, it's the 4th edition Centaur, it's sort of a mix, and it's inspiring and a really twisted set of mechanics for Retrievers. So I think reading through that is just inspiration to say, hey, I want this monster in my next adventure. That's what I love about these things.
Get the newest releases at RPG Now. Only at RPG Now can you get the absolute latest and best releases from fantastic publishers like Palladium Books and White Wolf Publishing. There are new products every single day. Come to RPGNow.com and get them the instant they're available.
All right, so now it is time to build our human warlord, which I know wasn't your first pick of things to build. I know you have a
lot of... No, dwarves!
I have a lot of love in my heart for dwarves as well, and I believe you even wanted to go dwarven, was it warlock?
I was ready to go dwarven warlock because I've got a product coming out soon called The Iron Gazetteer, and it's a 4th edition sourcebook for dwarf PCs, and it'll ship in August, and I'm really excited about it because we're doing interesting things like dwarven mountain druids. But all right, we're not doing that today. We're doing human warlords.
We're going to do the human warlord because we've already talked about warlocks in another advice episode. And we've already talked about dwarves in another advice episode. So today we're going to do a human warlord to cover some new ground.
I think that's a fine choice.
And as usual, I'm going to use the D&D Insider character builder for the process so that I have access to feats and powers and what have you from all sorts of different sources so that people can get an idea of what's out there for this type of character from all across the Wizards of the Coast line.
All right.
So usually when we do these, I set up three keywords or three key concepts that we try to use to guide the building of our warlord. And in this case, I believe we went with we wanted him to be a buffer. We wanted this person to be somebody who can spend a lot of time buffing the rest of the party. This is going to be a character that shines when the rest of the party does cool stuff.
Absolutely.
The next one was we wanted to make him a backup healer because warlords are good at healing, but not as good as some other classes.
Yeah, but good enough to help you in a pinch.
Absolutely. So I think backup healer is a good role there. And then I usually like to mix something in that's a little more story-based and see if we can mechanically sort of hit those notes. And so I said we should try to make our warlord a member of nobility.
Right.
And see if we can bring that into the creation process as well. So human and warlord, how did those complement each other?
Well, I mean, human complements pretty much everything, right? Because you get the extra, goodies, basically. Mm-hmm. So you get your extra power, you get your extra feat. Beyond that, I don't know. I think both in terms of flavor and in terms of mechanics, right? Mm-hmm. You're versatile,
actually, I'm trying to come up with a character concept, the halfling warlord, right? It doesn't it doesn't gel for me as
a
character concept.
Feel quite as right, does it?
No, it doesn't, right? All the big races feel more like warlords, humans and dragonborn and tieflings.
Halflings don't generally feel as militaristic, and warlord kind of by definition does.
Yeah, it kind of does. Plus, I mean, hey, having the choice of extra skills and the extra defense bonuses for humans, I mean, it's just... humans as a race kind of fit into everything, so it's not hard to make them fit into warlord.
They are by far the most flexible of the races because you can put that stat bonus anywhere, and then you've got the extra goodies to sort of help build whatever it is you want to build with it.
Yep.
So looking at the different options for our warlord, we've got a couple of different sort of commanding presences that we can choose from that guide the rest of the build.
Yeah.
We've got the two from Player's Handbook, which is Inspiring Presence and Tactical Presence.
And Inspiring Presence really fits pretty well into your theme here.
Right. It does a nice job because that one, basically when an ally spends an action point, they gain hit points. So it makes, makes this warlord a pretty decent backup healer. Even without really having to do anything, just by being around, you can help somebody heal in a pinch.
Right. I mean, it's not a lot of points, but everyone in the party can use it when they need it, and they're generally spending their action point when they're kind of desperate anyway, or trying to make the big finish.
Yeah. And then we've also got two commanding presences to choose from Martial Power. The Bravura Presence, which I always struggle to pronounce. And the Resourceful Presence, both of which I think you could also sort of justify for a character that's trying to help with hit points and to buff. You know, Resourceful Presence is giving temporary hit points, which sort of fills both of those roles as being a buffer and a backup healer.
Yep.
Preemptive healing, so to speak. So which way do you think we should go with this? Inspiring? I'm thinking either Inspiring or Resourceful.
I kind of like the classic Inspiring. Resourceful works too. I guess maybe I'm leaning toward Inspiring because that's what the warlord in my home game uses, and it seems to work pretty well.
Let's do it.
All right.
All right. So with an Inspiring Presence warlord, what kind of stats do we want to focus on?
Well, we're going to want charisma.
Uh-huh.
And we're going to need strength for the attacks.
So really dump as much there as possible and then
yeah.
Where do we mitigate in other areas? What do we want to make sure isn't too weak? Intelligence?
Intelligence needs to be okay. I think charisma, you know, charisma and strength got to be great. Intelligence can't suck. It's got to be decent. And beyond that, yeah, I would say constitution isn't that big a deal.
Yeah.
Dexterity is always nice, but you get some human bonuses maybe there on saves.
Yeah, where should we put that human bonus? You think charisma?
I would put it in charisma without too much doubt.
Yeah, I think so. Now, going through the character builder, as I just sort of hit auto-pick, have it automatically assign our stats, and it put an 18 in strength.
Okay,
And left charisma at a 14, which we then bumped up to a 16 with the human bonus. But I don't know. If it was me, I think I might almost flip those. You know, I'd want the strength to be my middling stat, and I'd want charisma to be my big stat.
Well, especially if we're still sort of thinking about that nobility aspect as well, that kind of implies to me that when we get to skills, we're going to pick up things like diplomacy and just generally part of the character concept is charismatic. Yeah, I'd flip them.
Yeah. And what I was able to do is I knocked the strength down to a 16, which allowed me to bump the charisma up to a 17 before modification. So it's a total of 19. And I think that fits our concept a lot better.
I think so. Yeah, I like it.
Good. So what about skills? We've got a lot of skills because we've got our four warlord skills to choose from, plus we're human, plus, so we get an extra.
Yeah. Well, we got to have diplomacy and we got to have heal, right?
Yes. And we're really, it's really more of a choice of what don't we take. Because
yeah, there's only like six,
there's
really.
There's six and we get to choose five. So
right. So what are we not taking?
I mean, I think history is a no-brainer for somebody who's going to be nobility.
Yes. Athletics should probably stay. What is that?
So then we're between intimidate and endurance.
Oh, man. Well,
I guess I might almost go intimidate.
Yeah.
Sometimes nobility can kind of be in your face and intimidating and push people around.
Absolutely. You peons, do what I say or I will get you fired, that sort of thing.
So.
Yeah. And that means we drop endurance. So.
Which I think this guy works out okay.
Yeah. He's not a tough guy that way.
Right. But he's not really supposed to be because we're building him to sort of sit behind the front lines and.
Yep, he's the backup healer and the buffer.
And help people, so.
So,
yep.
Exactly.
Or maybe he's just too much of a coward being nobility to get up in the front lines. I don't know.
I don't know. I like some of the warlord stuff like lead the attack and some of those other.
Yeah.
So we'll see. We'll see where we take it.
We've got a couple of feats to pick.
Yep. Wow, feats. You know, the human feats aren't bad. The, what is it, action surge or something like that? It's okay.
Sounds right. I know that the character builder is suggesting human perseverance, which is just a bonus, a plus one to saves.
That's the other human feat, yeah, which
is
I
always
really
a good
like.
Idea.
Yeah, I actually
although,
like human perseverance.
In terms of sticking with our keywords, I'm kind of liking improved inspiring word.
Oh, yeah.
To bump up our hit points that we restore as a healer.
Right. Right.
And I'm
that's
also
going to make a huge, that would make a huge difference.
Yeah. And I'm also liking saving inspiration, which is from Martial Power. When you use inspiring word, you can, instead of healing, allow an ally to make a saving throw.
Oh yeah. Well, it sort of depends on your campaign. I've seen that used effectively, but sometimes it's so conditional, right? It's like people may have their own powers for that.
I guess
it fits.
I guess in the campaigns I've been in or run, saving throws
it comes up.
Have been huge, you know.
Yep.
When you're facing that beholder and you're slowly turning to stone and you really don't want to mess up that last save, let's give him that bonus save here before it's too late.
That generally makes the difference. So, yeah, that's you know, it depends. Are you the kind of player who would prefer to get the save for your character or get the save for the other guy? How generous are you?
Well, and then we've also got some decent class ones, like the improved inspiration. You know, we went with the inspiring presence that heals people when they use an action point. Improved inspiration gets them a bonus two hit points when they use it.
Yep.
So that's also a good choice in terms of healing. We seem to be doing a lot of healing though,
and we're doing a lot of healing, not necessarily by helping people spend their surges, which I guess are in the powers more, but a few points here, a few points there. I mean, that is sort of backup healing.
Although I'm wondering if we shouldn't try to find a better way to focus on that buffing ability.
Right.
And, you know, I see things like inspired defense, where an ally gets a bonus to defenses when they're hit with an inspiring word, which adds a little bit of buffing, or lend might, which gives them a bonus to attack rolls if I grant them an attack.
Right. Well, I'm sort of seeing, the attack roll bonus is awfully nice.
Should we go with Lynn Mike? Because, I mean, if we're going to build his powers to make the allies look cool, then this is definitely in that line.
Let's go with Lynn Mike, just so that we don't feel, I mean, as the point feel all the time like, oh, I'm the healer, I've got nothing else.
Yeah.
So even though we have these keywords, even though we have this character concept, I think breaking out of that with some cool attacks or some cool powers, it's a nice change up so you don't feel like you're stuck in a single.
And it's worth noting for people looking to build their warlord that both of these feats that we've chosen are for martial power.
Yeah, actually.
We went classic with some of our early build options, and now we're starting to branch out a lot, it looks like.
Yeah.
So let's look at at-will feat or at-will powers.
Okay.
We've got a 4 to choose from Player's Handbook. We've got 2 from Martial Power, and then we've also got 1 from the Player's Handbook Heroes, the cards they give out with the miniatures.
Oh, jeez. See, that one I don't have.
I know. That's why I love the character builder.
Exactly.
It's got everything. I've said to many people, and I have a hard time convincing them, that if you want to play D&D on the cheap, D&D Insider is the cheapest way to do it, because you never have to buy a single book.
Yeah, it's true. Instead of buying a book a month, you're basically paying a lot less.
Yeah. But
moving on.
We have to choose some at-will powers. Are there any that you like for our warlord?
I'm a big fan of there's a lot.
Yeah. Well, we want to focus on ones that hit our charisma and our strength, because those are the stats.
Yeah, I am a big fan of lead the attack as a daily.
Okay.
But then we're already sort of skipping ahead to the daily. So I guess we're at the at-will.
Yeah. I always like Wolfpack Tactics.
Yeah, Viper Strike is fine. Wolfpack Tactics is the free shift got to be pretty huge.
The free shift can, I mean, if you've got a rogue in the party, that can be the entire tactic of the encounter. Is
right.
Shift that rogue into flanking so they're doing sneak attack all the time. And it sort of goes along with the idea of helping out your party with our buffer concept.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm fine with Wolfpack Tactics. I think that's a good way to go.
Okay.
It's solid. We don't have to go off to the weird minis card power.
Yeah, I haven't even looked at it. It's Rousing Assault.
I don't know it.
It does 1 weapon plus strength. Add your charisma modifier to the hit points restored with any warlord healing power you use before the end of your next turn. So it does actually boost your ability to heal.
Yeah. Oh, it's not bad, but it forces your next action to be a healing.
But you can heal as a minor with Inspiring Artist. You can do it in the same round.
Right. I mean, you sort of chain it up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's not a bad combination. I actually might suggest going that way. But then you've either got to have that card or have D&D Insider.
Yeah.
But because we're human, we get an extra at will. So let's go ahead and pick that, and then we still have another one to look at.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, let's take them both.
We're human,
right?
That's right. Should we look at one of the powers from Martial Power, maybe?
All right, sure. What do you recommend?
Well, Opening Shove is an intelligence-based one, and our stats don't really support that.
No.
Which leaves Brash Assault, which is 1 weapon plus strength, and it has an effect that the target can make a melee basic attack against you as a free action and has combat advantage for the attack. If the target makes the attack and an ally... If the target makes this attack, an ally of your choice within 5 squares of the target can make a basic attack against the target as a free action. So it's sort of the let me draw their attention and get them to attack me, and you get a free
and
shot
you,
at them.
Right.
It's a very self-sacrificing power. I'm not sure how much I like it.
Yeah, it's sort of self-sacrificing. I'm not sure if it fits our character. It doesn't muddy the combat waters, but it goes off on a tangent. I'm not crazy about it.
In hindsight, I'm not either. I'm more likely, I think, to go with Furious Smash now.
Yeah. Okay.
Should we pick that
it's
for
classic.
Our... Yeah, I mean, we go back to a player's handbook power. I mean, it's basically either that or Viper Strike.
Okay. Well, I like Viper Strike, but...
We can go Viper Strike.
Okay.
Let's go for it. So Viper Strike, which does one weapon plus strength, and it shifts the target.
Yeah.
So once again, you're moving things around the battlefield. You're almost turning into a...
If the target shifts.
Oh, if the target shifts.
Yeah, it's not... You don't get to shift them, but if they decide to go shifting, people beat up on them. Which, depending on the characters you've got, right, may get you a lot of extra opportunity attacks,
right. Well, and that's... you almost got a little bit of controller creeping into your leader with that one.
Yeah, you really do.
You're telling your enemies either don't shift or we're going to take the extra attack.
Yep.
So let's go to dailies.
Okay.
You like lead the attack.
I really do. It's a fun thing to do role-playing wise. You get to sort of, rally the troops. And unfortunately, it's intelligence-based.
Yeah, I was going to say.
So I guess I should have thought of that. Yeah, maybe it's not ideal for this build.
Now, you have one that's similar in flavor, but is not intelligence-based, out of martial power, called Lead by Example.
Okay.
Which is two weapon plus strength, and allies gain combat advantage against the target until the start of your next turn.
Yeah.
So that's not too shabby in terms of you get to do some damage, but you're also buffing, you're making it easier for the party to hit this guy.
Right. Well, not too shabby, granting combat advantage and mass, so.
Yeah. So maybe.
Yeah, that's a decent buff.
Is that the way to go?
I think that's the way to go with the daily then.
Okay, so lead by example.
It's that or something like Bastion of Defense.
Yeah. But, I mean, we're going to have a lot of opportunities as this character levels up, especially, I think, in a lot of the utilities and that kind of stuff, that you start seeing a lot more buffing ability.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So what about encounter power?
We skipped past that, didn't we?
Well, character builder wanted me to do that last, I guess. I don't know.
I don't know why I always pick my daily last, usually, but...
I do, too.
It feels like the biggest decision, but... they're mostly strength based out of the player's handbook. So really we've got our choice.
I'm hesitant to take something like Warlord's Favor because it gets the extra boost from tactical presence, which we didn't go with.
Which we didn't take, right?
But Guarding Attack does get the bonus from Inspiring Presence.
Yes, it does, and that's our charisma right there. It's that or something like Hammer and Anvil, but my experience with Hammer and Anvil is it reads better than it plays.
Oh, yeah?
Well, one ally adjacent, right, makes a melee basic attack as a free action and gets your charisma modifier on it, on the damage, I think. But, I don't know, you're granting a free basic attack, which seems awfully cool, but it does mean that you're putting yourself right up there. And we were think as not quite the frontline guy.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Maybe guarding attack is better.
I think guarding attack is the way to go. I'm sort of flipping through some of the ones from Martial Power, and there's even one in here from Dragon Magazine, which are all pretty decent, but I think guarding attack probably goes along better with our idea of being a buffer and with the build that we have.
Yeah. Well, the bonus to armor class is awfully nice.
Oh, yeah. And that's a big buff.
Yeah, it is. What's our charisma? 19?
Charisma is 19.
It okay.
Won't, and it won't be too long before it's a 20.
Right. yeah. Yeah, I think that's probably the way to go.
All right. So that basically builds our character. Is there anything that we want to, anything else we want to be looking at with this guy? For the future, any powers that stand out to you, any feats that you want to grab or paragon paths that are interesting for this kind of concept?
Well, I haven't thought as far ahead as paragon path, but I think sort of in the short to medium term future, right? It depends on what you like. I certainly think that some of the utilities that help you spend a target, spend a healing surge, are probably going to come into play, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like aid the injured, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can do a lot with a warlord if you pick their in terms of healing, if you pick the right powers.
Right. It depends on what's the rest of your party, right? If you've got a paladin and a cleric, I mean, maybe you're fine with being able to spend all your surges. But if not, if your party is a bunch of strikers and your cleric spends a lot of powers on not quite so healing intensive things, uh-huh, then maybe you do go that road. So, I mean, yeah, this is something you learn through play, is what does your party need? And flexible as they are, you can kind of fit yourself to that.
Yeah, you can. And you don't have to solidify yourself into that role at level one either. I mean, you can sort of see how it goes for the first several levels and then start guiding yourself one direction or another. Which is where the warlord ends up having a lot of flexibility.
A really nice thing about the class, and it's certainly for players who like getting the rest of the party up to speed and granting bonuses.
And it's certainly one of those classes that I think it almost takes a little bit more of a mature player.
Yep.
Because the warlord is cool when the rest of the party is doing cool things.
Yes.
Not when the warlord is doing cool things.
Not generally. I mean, once in a while you'll get to shout something like, I'm leading the attack, and they give everybody a bonus and the spotlight is on you.
Right.
But most of the time you're a little bit more of, my group calls it the combat bureaucrat.
Yes.
It's like, oh, well, I'm giving you a bonus, and if you fill out this form and take a shift, you'll get a bonus. And if you make this hit, then he gets a saving throw, right? So,
yeah. Well, and
so he's
the
tracking
only,
everyone else.
I guess the last thing I would sort of keep an eye out for as you continue building this warlord is when you start equipping him, it may be a good idea to take a weapon, a melee weapon that has reach, so you can sit behind the front lines, but still impact the combat as if you were in that front line.
Yes.
But be flexible to be wherever you need to be to give your buffs or heal wherever you need to heal.
I think that's a very smart piece of advice. A reach weapon for a warlord is a nice move.
All right, so that's our human warlord.
Excellent.
Before we talk about building a better monster, I'm going to talk about our second sponsor, GamersAttic.com. Don't forget, listeners, that with the coupon code RADIO, you can get $3 off a purchase of $30 or more. If you use the coupon, the sponsor will know that you're coming from the Tome Show, and hopefully they'll keep helping us pay our bills. My pick for this episode is Kobold Quarterly number 9. Surprise.
Hey, hooray.
It is currently a little bit more than $7 at GamersAttic.com. And Wolfgang, since you published this one as well, what can people expect to find in KQ9?
Well, KQ9 has been out for a little while, but it is full of goodies. The thing that I'm always going to remember about this issue is that it's got the interview with Dave Arneson in it.
Wow.
Yeah. And that's an interview we started pursuing about a year and a half ago. That is what it is. And we're very grateful to have gotten that last interview with him. In addition, we also launched a series, a column by Monty Cook in KQ9 called Game Theories. Monty's going to be in every issue talking about game design and dungeon mastery.
Well, you think Monty could find a few more hats to wear?
You know, he was out of the industry and now he's back in. And I'm, for one, I'm actually kind of grateful.
I'm glad he's back. But for somebody who's retired several times from the industry, he's more active now than just about anybody.
Yeah, no, he really is. But, I mean, for 4th edition players, we got stuff here. The Ecology of the Maenad has a 4th edition sort of spin on a psionic PC race. And there's also the Kitsune, where we offered up both 3rd and 4th edition stats for the fox, weird creature, Japanese shapeshifters. We had something called Chasing the Grave, which is about magic drug use, I think is one way to put it.
Right on.
A certain magical drug called Requiem, which allows you to speak with the dead. And there's some downsides to that, oddly enough.
There's downsides to drug use? What?
Yes, there are. People chasing the grave, talking to the dead, and starting to live in the afterlife a little more than in the real world. But our fantasy world. And, oh, there's a bandit lair with a complete 3D map as well, useful in any campaign. So, I mean, it's packed with stuff.
It's packed with stuff, and it's 3rd edition and 4th edition, more so than ever. I know the first year or so was mostly 3rd edition with a little bit of 4th creeping in. And
absolutely.
And now we're seeing more and more of a combination.
And, you know, it's not even that we were, like, so hardcore about 3rd edition. It's just we didn't get any good 4th edition submissions for a while after the game was released.
Yeah.
It's like, wow, well, A, no queries, and B, the ones we got were like, nah, it's got to be good for us to run it. It can't just be 4th for 4th's sake. So now we're really hitting on it. I think people have mastered the system and have a sense of where they want it to go.
In a lot of ways, Kobold Quarterly is sort of the print version of this podcast, isn't it?
It is.
We talk about anything D&D, and you write about anything D&D.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, we do wander off into 3rd edition and Pathfinder sometimes, but we also that are of interest to any gamer, like the Dave Arneson interview or setting material or, you know, the Bat God of the Underworld.
Great.
Off we go.
So that's Kobold Quarterly 9 at GamersAttic.com.
Gamers Attic Attack. We have dice of every stripe, any color scheme and shape you can imagine. Exclusive dice, gold-plated dice, blank dice, label dice, cheat dice, D8 ability dice, crystal dice, time dice within dice, and jumbo foam dice for when you feel the inescapable urge to pelt your fellow players or annoying commercial announcers. And that's just a few of them. We sell enough dice to form a high-intensity plastic bridge from the Earth to the Moon. What's more, any order over $30 gets $3 off when you use the coupon code RADIO. Who wants a set?
I do.
Who else?
Me.
Anyone else?
Why are you ignoring me?
I'm not ignoring you. I'm cutting you off.
What?
You order a new set every day.
So?
Is there a 12-step program for Diceaholics? Because you, sir, have a problem.
That's really strange of you to say.
Green frosted, red speckled, violet glitter, blue translucent. You couldn't say no to these beauties if you wanted to.
I'm not an addict. I could stop collecting marbles anytime I like.
Marbles? You haven't been buying marbles this whole time. You've been buying dice.
That explains why I keep losing the marbles tournament. Those 4- and 6-sided marbles aren't really all that great for rolling.
You're not only a dice junkie, you're dumb, son. Dumb.
So can I get a set?
What'll it hurt? Sure.
Woohoo! Marbles!
Remember, folks, use the coupon code RADIO to get $3 off any order over $30 at GamersAttic.com.
And now we're back to talk about building unique monsters. Wolfgang, you profess to have a unique experience with this, so what advice can you give?
Well, I've been building monsters a long time. I think it is the monsters that have always drawn me into D&D because I'm always on the DM side of the screen and the monsters are my characters, right? So I don't actually get to play on the player side that often, so I need to have monsters that keep me entertained and keep the players entertained. And from my perspective, when I'm designing any monster, there's a couple of things I like to do that make a difference to the way I run them at the table and to the way people read them when they're just reading an adventure. Mm-hmm. One is, and I mean, this is not mechanical at all, but if there's any chance at all that the players are going to talk to this creature, give it a name. It seems really obvious, but, you know, sometimes the party is wounded and they decide to talk to the guard and try and bribe their way in instead of beating them up. Well, it's a lot easier for me to run the guy if I can say, hey, I'm Captain Name here, instead of, the answer to what's your name and who are you being me fumbling around. So, I mean, I'm really a fan of, hey, name your monsters.
Well, and if nothing else, it helps give you an idea of where to go with that character's personality, too. I know whenever I hear a name, it gives it as a DM. It starts giving me some ideas as to how this monster might act and how they might
behave. Yeah, absolutely. You know, a troll named Vaprak the Destroyer is probably different from a troll named, Peppercorn. Or
Grimash the Weak. No.
Yeah, Grimash the Weak. It's like, well, that's the troll that gets kicked around. Yeah. Okay.
And I guess in terms of giving your monster's personality, I've always – there was an old is it Dungeon Craft article that was part of a series in the old magazines. And they gave some – one of these articles gave some advice that I've always kept in mind ever since, and it's worked really well for me, and that's give everybody a mystery. You know,
yeah.
Every monster, every NPC, everybody's got something that they don't want people to find out about. And it may not come into the storyline at all. It may not have anything to do with anything.
Or it may be major, like, you know, Smaug the Dragon is missing an important scale.
Yes.
Right?
Right. And it could be little stuff like, you know, the shopkeeper that you're buying that canoe from is secretly in love with the weaponsmith down the street. You know, it never comes into play, but as a DM, I mean, this character might only be around for a few minutes, but as a DM, it does help me know who this character is and behave accordingly.
Yep. Right. And so, I mean, absolutely. Weaknesses, mysteries, and a name are all sort of role-playing aspects that I think are so much easier to set up ahead of time. And you give it 2 minutes thought before you're at the table, and you're so much better prepared when the encounter goes that direction. That said, of course, the mechanical side is just as important. I would certainly want to do monster design, keeping in mind that, hey, they need to be interesting once we roll initiative, too. And I guess the example I'd bring up here is one that I designed for a Pathfinder adventure called Fortress of the Stone Giants, and it's some shining child of Thassilon, and it's an ancient evil thing from other planes, and it's got some Cthulhoid overtones. But the one good trick it has is something that Fourth edition actually does now as well, but at the time set you on fire, right? Mm-hmm. And once it hits you, you stay on fire. Now the game has supported that sort of thing mechanically for a long time, but what happens, of course, at the table is when you tell somebody that their character is on fire, you get a different reaction than when you say, well, you took 10 points of damage. It's entertaining, right? The other people start to react to that. Hey, he's on fire. And it's mechanically interesting because every round he's taking so many points of fire damage. And this is what I love about ongoing damage in fourth edition, right? It mm-hmm. took that idea. I mean, they didn't take it from me, but the same premise is there. Okay, fine. They read my Pathfinder adventure and that inspired.
That's right. They did. We're going to give you credit for that, and I think you should demand royalties.
That's right. I'll be calling Hasbro in the morning. But, I mean, I love the fact that that sort of mechanic is built into the game now, and that you can build a monster to take advantage of those things. And I think when they do have ongoing damage, you should be reinforcing that at the table when you run it.
So what can you do for a fourth edition monster, now that that's a little more commonplace, and it doesn't have that unique, you know, oh crap, Bill's on fire sort of effect, because it happens a lot more often in fourth edition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
What kind of monster design can you recommend that's still going to sort of give people that, oh crap, what are we going to do about Bill sort of impact?
Well, I think there's a couple things you can do. Generally, if you have a boss monster or a monster who's supposed to be, you know, a big finale elite kind of thing, I like to cheat sometimes in monster design and hit them where it hurts most. And that generally doesn't mean damage and extra saving throws. It more often means things like, hey, they're hitting you and you're losing a healing surge. They're hitting you and you are going to be disarmed. Your implement disappears.
So you're a big fan of the new Rust monster.
Yes, okay. I am. I'm a big fan of the new Rust monster. I think they did it. And there's many other creatures that could work this way, right? I mean, it could just be the Black Knight of the Gate, who essentially, on any hit, disarms his opponent, right? I mean, mm-hmm. you're taking something away, not necessarily taking it away permanently, but you're changing the dynamic of the encounter is what you're doing.
Sure. And I think there's a lot of places where that could be used in monster design and hasn't been. You know, when we did our review of the Monster Manual 2 with the Rust Monster, somebody brought up that it would have made a lot of sense to do a similar sort of mechanic with the Bebelith, which has a power that tears up your armor.
Right.
But mechanically, it doesn't actually destroy your armor.
I know.
You know, and they're like, you know, they really missed an opportunity there to
oh, they chickened out.
To hit him where it hurts, you know?
I know. And, I mean, there's sort of this trade-off between, yeah, you hit him where it hurts, and are you really being fair to the players, right? Because they work hard. They get these treasures. They build up these items. You don't want to just trash them all the time.
You don't want to do it often, but every now and then for that wow
right,
factor,
which is,
I think
exactly,
well.
And that's why I say it's for the big boss. It's for that doppelganger they've been pursuing for the last three levels, right? If you don't hurt them and if you're not ruthless in those sorts of design situations, the players are going to feel let down. Hey, that encounter, you know, that cost us nothing.
Yeah.
So
any other ideas on how to make monsters awesome?
I mean, there's sort of the split between when you're designing for a specific encounter, which is what I've been talking to so far, something that's going to last, right? Something that's going into a magazine article in Kobold Quarterly or something that's going into a monster manual. In those cases, you know, naming the monster is less important. You're thinking less about the elite version than the basic version. I guess, you know, there's been so much good monster design, but there's also, there's so many opportunities that have never been touched. Kobold Quarterly does something called the Monday Monster, and we post a third edition or fourth edition monster every Monday. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them are drawn from history and myth that nobody knows.
Yeah.
Like the Unicorn, who goes around impregnating various peasant girls, right? I mean, okay, so he's got a weird backstory.
It's possible that nobody's touched them for a reason.
Well, it's possible, but Kobold Quarterly isn't Hasbro, right? It's like
absolutely.
We're not held to the standards of the same company that publishes candy.
Right.
So we can go do that, right? And we do. That's what the Chasing the Grave drug article was about, right?
Right.
Let's talk about that. So we do that stuff. And sometimes that bit of mythology then inspires a design that will stand the test of time is really my point. Because
I think with fourth edition being relatively new still,
mm-hmm.
at about a year old, and people are really just sort of starting to gear up, and third-party publishers are you know, just barely starting to dip their toe in the water, you know.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of design space there that hasn't been explored, and it's hard from this end of it, not being, you know, generally in the industry on a regular basis, to think of interesting and unique ways to use that design space. But then when I talk to people who are writing or are working in the industry, even just freelance every now and then kind of stuff, their head's in a very different place, and they're coming up with all these really cool and unique ideas on what you can do with the mechanics that never even occur to the rest of us.
Oh, absolutely. Things like ongoing damage have sort of downstream mechanical consequences that we get to play with for the next few years, right?
Mm-hmm.
And many other elements of fourth edition are the same way. They give us new design space. And I think where it gets interesting is when we say, hey, let's go out, find a really cool mythological hook, something that people have been using in storytelling for 100, 600 years, and combine it with these cool new mechanics and then make it into something that, you know, gets published in every monster manual from here on out.
Yeah. Good.
That's where I'm at with monsters. I'm going to be doing more of them.
Awesome. So we talked about, just to quickly review what we've hit so far, we built our human warlord, and we basically went very charisma and strength-based in order to hit our keynotes of being a backup healer and a buffer. And we said that going with a reach weapon is probably a good idea.
Yes, we did.
We talked about monster design, and you could sort of summarize it as give your monsters a name and a personality and make them do something that your players aren't expecting so that you can surprise them. And when appropriate, hit them where it hurts.
Yeah.
And I think we've got a few minutes left here, and I was going to ask you about one last topic that wasn't originally on the agenda.
Okay.
But you were instrumental in the design of a setting called Al-Qadim in 2nd edition.
Oh, how I love it.
And one of the things, I played a lot of Al-Qadim in college,
mm-hmm.
Just before 3rd edition came out. And one of the things I loved about Al-Qadim was I always got a sense of the culture. You know, it was unique and it was different, but I always felt like I was in that world because that culture came to life. So I thought maybe you could give a few pointers to the DMs out there. And how do you bring the culture of your campaign setting to life? What can you do to sort of hit those strokes and make the players feel like they're in that world? And it's not just, you know, a generic game setting, but it's,
right.
but it's that world.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple of things. I think the big mistake that people make with culture, and DMs and game designers both are prone to this, is to try to do too much. Right? You're doing your world building, you're looking at the depth and scope of Arabian culture, you're reading all this stuff, and you're immersed in it, and then you want to share it all at once with the players, like in the first session or the first adventure. And honestly,
can't hand them a big manual full of stuff. This is what you need to know about the world.
Exactly. Yeah. It's like, well, here's everything you need to know about, you know, and you know, the culture of mealtime and how to bury a deceased comrade. It's like, well, we don't need to know all that right now, do we? No, it's a 12-page manual. Please memorize it. So first off, I'd say your best bet is to try and hit the same and in context. So what I mean by that is every time the players stop for an extended rest, you know, you might talk about the fact that, well, it's an Arabian culture, and what they drink is tea or coffee as opposed to water and ale, right? So a simple thing like, hey, this is the food you have, or the food you don't have and you miss it, and gosh, wouldn't it be nice to go back to town sometime, guys? Or put other things in context, right? If it happens to be a slaveholding culture, really just mentioning that is usually enough to make people go, oh, this is a different society. Mm-hmm. That is strange.
Yeah,
and if they have questions, they'll ask.
Right. And I found one of the things that really bring a world to life for me is the way that people behave and the way people believe in that world.
Yes.
So a lot of it's just interactions with NPCs that really...
Yeah, if you can just give them all of that through NPCs, I mean, my cheat sheets tend to be 4 bullet points on the inside of my screen, like, you know, what is this city about? Bullet point 1, 2, 3, 4.
Yeah.
And if I can bring one of those up when they visit the place through the mouth of an NPC, then I know I've got the job right.
At the same time, if you sort of tailor some of your mechanics, I think... You can sort of...
Yeah, like the Bond of Salt in Al-Qadim, right?
Yeah,
it's tailor-made for mechanics.
Oh, right. Well, and I was even thinking the barber kit back in Al-Qadim. You know, that you know, the idea of a barber, and yet he's a deadly killer...
Yes.
tells us so much about what that world is like and gives us a sense of the grit that you can get into in this world.
Well, I mean, the ideal is that your players start to parrot the culture back to you, right? Like,
right.
They'll do the Bond of Salt thing, or they'll say, hey, because I'm in an Arabian culture, I could do that. So they pick up and they run with it.
Yeah.
If you can give them mechanical elements as well that reward them for playing the culture, second edition kits were perfect for this.
Mm-hmm.
In 4th edition, I would say it's probably backgrounds and maybe a couple of specialized feats that you would need to kit bash yourself.
And some of the Paragon paths can give a little bit of that, too. You know,
That's true.
I look at Forgotten Realms, and you've got your Purple Dragon Knights and that kind of stuff.
Yes. Yes. If you could get together with some folks and do up a set of Al-Qadim Paragon paths, you're set. I mean, then people buy into it as well, right? Because then they're saying, I'm a member of the Brotherhood of Fire, And here's what that means mechanically, and here's what that means in the setting,
right?
And the story.
And I think I've even done some interesting campaigns where, given all the stuff that's out there, as a DM restricting what's usable,
mm-hmm.
guides the setting to a point that the players feel like they're part of it. You know, if they're allowed to be the exception to every rule, then sometimes it's hard to get them to buy into the fact that that you're the exception, that that's just not the way the world is. You know?
Yeah.
So sometimes it's better not, sometimes, not, and not always, but sometimes it's better not to let them always be the exception to everything.
Yeah. I actually have a whole rant on that topic, but I suspect we don't have time for it today. But yeah, the kitchen sink campaign setting or the kitchen sink party where everybody can do everything and you've got your Thrykreen Mantis Warrior next to your Ants Dragonborn and there's not a human in the party. Sigh. You guys are totally optimized, and yet you don't fit in anywhere. And
yeah.
So it's like the Motley Crue that doesn't have a stake in the setting because they're all rogue two scimitar types with a
yeah.
It just
and it's a balance, you know, because I struggle with it myself because as a DM I like the mm-hmm. idea of restricting to keep it
yes.
to keep make it feel like the campaign setting.
Sure, but as a player, of course.
As a player, I always want to be the exception to the rule.
Of course, you want your character to shine. But I think there's ways to make a character shine within this set.
Yeah.
You know, you're the paladin who left the order. Well, you're still a paladin from the order that exists in the setting. It's just your relationship to the rest of the paladins is a little different.
Yeah.
So.
All right. Well, I think we've hit that in brief pretty good. And I wanted to thank you again for joining me in episode 110.
Oh, thank you.
If people want to find out what you're up to, where should they go look?
Well, they should come to KobaltQuarterly.com. We have posts there pretty much every day. New monsters, we have game advice, we have interviews with designers like Bruce Cordell. We talk about games.
Sweet. And people can always email me at thetomeshow@gmail.com or visit the forums. Review the show on iTunes or tell folks about it. Don't forget to consider checking out the RPG Shop affiliate link and the Amazon store for products discussed on this show and more. We get part of the proceeds and that helps keep us on the air. Links for things mentioned on the show can be found in the show notes on the website at thetomeshow.com, including a link over to KoboldQuarterly.com. I'll probably link up to Open Design as well.
Sure. The Open Design site, I should mention, is really restricted to the patrons of the current projects. Most of the good content there is hidden, unless you're a member.
Okay. I know for a while that was sort of where to go to find Wolfgang, but I think as Kobold Quarterly has come out, you've shifted your public face.
You're absolutely right. Yes. The main public site now is KoboldQuarterly.com. It's got the forums. It's got the articles, monsters, spells, traps, and items, you name it. The store. It's all there.
Great. And all of that will be linked, again, at thetomeshow.com. This has been episode 110, Human Warlord and Making Unique Monsters of...
I'm on the wall.